Good afternoon and welcome to the Commonwealth Club and this program of the Bay Gourmet Forum. It is my pleasure to introduce Vivian Sosnowski, who has been an editorial director of newspapers, including the Washington, D.C. Examiner and the San Francisco Examiner. She is also a very gifted photographer whose portraits of the wine country pioneers were the genesis of this book. In her new book, When Rivers Ran Red, she details the enthralling true story of California winemakers and their battle to survive Prohibition. She explores the passion of these vintners to preserve one of America's most beloved and romantic industries. With their livelihoods in jeopardy and limited options available to them, winemakers across Napa and Sonoma counties kept the wine industry alive through its darkest years. I don't know about you, but I'm really looking forward to knowing more about that period of California's history. Thank you, and let's welcome Vivian.
Thank you so much. And thank you, all of you, for coming out today and giving me this opportunity to talk about how wine survived Prohibition. And thanks to Kathy Curtis for helping set this up with the Commonwealth Club. It's a great honor to be here. As we come to the 90th anniversary of Prohibition next January, it seemed like just the right time to look back to see how winemakers and grape growers in the fabulous premium wine countries of California, Napa and Sonoma essentially, triumphed over that terrible time. Prohibition, as we know, officially began in January of 1920 and ended in December of 1933, although there had been a soft form of prohibition before that called the wartime prohibition. So essentially there were 14 years in California where it was illegal to sell wine, any wine, illegal to sell it at wineries, hotels or bars, even to move it from one storage place to another without special hard-to-get permits. You couldn't even keep your old winery signs up. As soon as prohibition began, the signs had to be covered or knocked down altogether. An acquaintance of mine was once launching a book, a mystery, and he said he thought he'd had difficulty talking about it without giving away the ending. Well, that's not an issue with this book, of course. We all know the ending. Prohibition happened. And we all know that there could have been myriad endings, and that is very true. Many in California's wine industry did survive, thanks to courage and ingenuity and lots of patience. There were also some whose land and homes did not make it. Yes, while some people in Napa and Sonoma became rich, extremely rich, and successful thanks to Prohibition, including some big grape ranchers and people like George de la Tour of Beaulieu Vineyard in Napa, who had some amazing arrangements with the Catholic Church and with the Archbishop of San Francisco and held vast sacramental wine licenses, all of which are documented in the book, but I won't go into those today. And other people were able to hold on by selling off land and growing other things besides grapes, often prunes, which they hated to grow. Still others had to sell out or had been forced to sell out during the 14 years of Prohibition, and some took heartbreaking losses. But as I set out to write the book, I found there was some mystifying data. For instance, as Prohibition began, there were about 700 wineries in California, 256 in Sonoma and 120 in Napa. By the end of Prohibition, only about 160 of that 700 remained. But mystifyingly, the total acres of wine grapes grew. In California, as Prohibition began, there were about 100,000 acres of wine grapes. When it ended, there were 178,000 acres of wine grapes, and there had been a high of 188,000 in 1930. Even in the 1960s, there were way less wine grape acreages available in use then. And just what happened, well, I'll get back to that in a minute. But interestingly, the numbers are not what the people and families I interviewed about Prohibition remember most. What is remembered so deeply by their families decades later was that so many of them had been forced to break the law by bootlegging or making grappa and selling it illicitly. It was not an easy decision to break the law for these proud, hardworking, and thrifty pioneers. They felt humiliated and bitter that they had been forced to do it. How this book came about was during a period when I had gone to work in Washington, D.C. And you know how it is. You move to a new town, you don't know that many people. So I would often walk up to the Library of Congress, which I think is the most beautiful national library in the world by far. And I loved to spend time there. And as I leafed through all sorts of documents, I found some intriguing quotes and discussions in old books about what had happened in Congress as the country's lawmakers fought over whether prohibition should happen or not. It was clearly an ugly, bitter battle that had gone on for a long time. And it was just as clear that hardly a soul in Congress, outside of a few Californian congressmen and a few others around New York and Maryland who knew about grapes, knew anything about wine. Hardly anyone on Capitol Hill knew anything about California's wine industry or cared about the people that had built it up. Because back in those days, Californians' wines were known and respected around the world, throughout Europe and Asia, as well as across the country, of course. California had a vast wine industry by the time Prohibition happened. It wasn't a few farmers working on remote vineyards. California wines had a global reputation. California wines, for instance, had been awarded many medals in the Paris International Exhibition of 1900. The great San Francisco earthquake of 1906 had destroyed millions and millions of gallons of wine that were stored in the city by winemakers, waiting to be sold here and across in the U.S. and around the world. The Asti Winery in Alexander Valley, for instance, could not only store than a million gallons of wine at their own winery, but it was said they had even more wines than that in their vaults down here near the ferry building when the earthquake hit. So important was the global market for California wines that the night before Prohibition began in January of 1920, many ships had steamed in a hurry from San Francisco's docks out through the Golden Gate for England and China, among other places, full of wines that had to be moved before the legal deadline to do so. They needed to get to international waters before Prohibition began. The same thing was happening at the Maryland port they were sending out ships to, with mostly with liquor that was going down to Jamaica and places like that where they would store and keep it. A lot of wine was also taken to Mexico, where people could keep it and sell it as they wished. During the same months as I was able to look through those federal documents of prohibition in Washington, I was flying home most weekends and working on a history project in Sonoma County. The history project was about wine country pioneers. My part involved taking these photographs of the pioneers. The photos are huge, and they now are in a permanent exhibit at Healdsburg City Hall. Do drop by if you ever get to Healdsburg when City Hall is open. Most of the pioneers I photographed were in their mid-90s. One was a wonderful woman of 97 who had just renewed her driver's license for 5 years. Another one was 106, so that meant that he was 19 when Prohibition started. Those photo sessions with the pioneers were astonishing to me. They told so many stories about their lives as we sat and photographed, and sometimes it took an hour or two or 3 hours. And they told amazing stories about Prohibition. Some of them had been in their teens when it happened, and they had vivid memories about raids on their ranches and their homes by the Prohis, which is what they called Prohibition agents. And as these pioneers grew older in their teens, many of them worked in the illicit businesses that were set up during that time. They drove sugar to stills late at night. They helped man the stills through the night for their parents when their parents had to go and sleep because they needed to work during the day. They helped turn the dregs from making wine into grappa or making brandy from wine. Or they drove wine hidden in trucks across the ferries to San Francisco to the huge illicit markets that were here. It seemed that someone should write their stories down while these wonderful folk were still with us. I looked around and there was no one else, so I thought, well, I'm a journalist, I should do it. And so I did. Amazingly, some of those pioneers were original wine families still making wine today. I did try in the book to write mostly about wineries that are still in the same hands that they've been during Prohibition. I thought that sense of continuity was amazing. Then to add to those reminiscences of the pioneers, of course, I did lots of other research, newspaper archives and the National Archives of this nation, which are wonderful. The archives of the Diocese of San Francisco contain details of the astonishing relationship I've mentioned between the Archbishop and a winemaker, and UC Davis has amazing files. But I realized that most of the people I knew, including myself, while we knew a great deal about Prohibition, much of what we knew was it happened in the East. We knew about Al Capone and gangsters and machine gun raids. And while many books have included some details about Prohibition and wine country, I felt there were still lots to tell. Luckily, meeting the wine country pioneers was a great starting point to find out what had happened. The difference between the stories in this book and the usual stories of Prohibition is that the story of Napa and Sonoma counties in Prohibition is about families, winemaking families, grape-growing families. The gangster Al Capone stories, by comparison, were about tough, hardened criminals in usually urban settings in the East. Here in California, especially in rural Napa and Sonoma, it was simple, honest, hard-working families who were forced to do things they had never dreamed they would have to do to keep their families fed and well. I'd like to read you first from the prologue of the book. It explains why the book is called When the Rivers Run Red, and it gives a good idea of one of the major tragedies for wine country families during Prohibition. Let me set the scene. We're in the Fopiano Vineyards in Sonoma County. The company is still to this day run by the young boy you will meet in the next paragraphs. He's 98 now, and I visit him regularly to chat. And only a few months ago, I had a glass of champagne with him to celebrate his birthday. He's feisty and active, and he still heads his vineyards. He's a very handsome man as well. So, when Prohibition began, there were millions and millions of gallons of wine in the cellars of California vineyards. This is what happened to so many of them. It's now 1926. We're 6 years into Prohibition, and many of the gallons of wine that were around at the beginning of Prohibition and locked and padlocked by Prohibition officers on the vineyards of the winemakers, it's now starting to age. So many people found that they could not afford to keep their wine when they had no income coming in from it. And this is a situation, what happened all too often. Bonds had to be paid each year so that you could keep it under padlock. And what happened was people found that they could no longer keep those bonds going. They had no income at all coming in. And the Fopiano family realized that their wines were aging, and they had come to the heartbreaking conclusion, as so many others had, that they could no longer keep their wine. So Prohibition agents arrived one dreadful morning to get rid of it as if it was nothing but garbage. They arrived on a day in the middle of the summer, hooked hoses to the tanks, and dragged those hoses to the road. Here from the book. I've written it in here so it saves me from rustling through the book. But a trickle of dark wine began to flow, slowly at first, hesitating a little, then with a deep-throated roar it became a torrent so mighty it was as if the heavens had been ripped open. A small crowd of men, women, and children who stood watching were stunned into silence. Their eyebrows lifted in astonishment as thousands upon thousands of gallons of wine began to stream past their feet. Moments later, they gasped as the flood bubbling around them grew deeper and wilder. Instinctively, they yelled in terror and in one great convulsion charged away, mothers and fathers pulling children almost out of their shirts as they dragged them out of harm's way. They turned to look back only when they felt they were far enough from the terrifying spectacle to be safe. The wine soon poured into every ditch and depression in its path. Small puddles grew into red lakes. Before the deluge was over, it had poured for almost 2 days. But this first day was the one that took everyone by surprise. As the flood finally settled to a steady flow, the crowd started to surge back towards it. They walked up to the edge of the small red lake that now stretched out before them and stared down. None of them had ever contemplated such a sight. One of the men knelt, leaned into the lake, and tentatively stuck his fingers into it. Gingerly he brought them to his lips, sucked, tasted, and turned to the others. What, they called. He smiled and chuckled, and the others stepped forward to taste the liquid, too. It was good wine. The wine had been aging like all wines, and the crowd had been expecting the worst. But from the first taste, good news, it had not turned too noticeably on the tongue. The wine was still drinkable, if not just a little sour. Yes, eminently drinkable. In seconds, everyone was shouting for help from the children, who ran as fast as their legs could carry them to bring the bottles, jugs, and pans they had carried from home for this moment. Now they began to fill every container they had, canning jars, milk bottles, olive oil containers, and more. Soon they were all filled and placed carefully in baby carriages or kids' wagons in the back seats of the many cars now surrounding the site. The crowd was jubilant. This was better than a vacation. Before them, after all, was a reservoir of free wine. Soon, up to 140,000 gallons of it would run from the hoses into the public ditches and beyond. 140,000 gallons. On a day still described with horror in their community 80 days later, Wine that represented many years of hard work was suddenly worth nothing at all. That momentous day did not spell bad luck for everyone. For neighbors who made the 15-minute trek south of the tiny farming commute of Healdsburg, it turned into a riotous holiday. But for the faux pianos, the day had been a cruel trial. Matilda, the proud head of the family, a pretty and composed young widow who had a responsibility for an entire winery and grape ranch, had walked on this tough day into the morning sunshine with her three children, Rosalind and Norma, and her youngest, Louis. He was 16 then and is a 98-year-old gentleman I still visit today. While Matilda crossed defiantly to where a line of huge redwood tanks held the fruits of several growing seasons. The Fulpianos had been making wine on this fertile Russian River Valley flatland since 1896, and none of them ever dreamed that one day they would be watched by federal agents, permits in hand and revolvers tucked into their waistbands, as they turned the taps to the hose connected to the bottom of their vast wine tanks, destroying what had taken so much exhausting work to produce. Newspapers reported afterwards that thousands of revelers had appeared at that wine dumping, had spent the afternoon drinking and dancing on the highway. Dancing wildly on the highway, it must have been a very hot day too. Families had spent the whole day there, and some had stayed well into the evening. One gentleman had brought a sleeping bag and drank and then slept, drank and then slept. One unfortunate soul had fallen over in the road and was hit by a car. He was taken to the hospital, fixed up, and then jailed for 30 days. This was just one of the many dozens and dozens and dozens of wine dumpings that happened throughout Prohibition in Napa and Sonoma counties. The dates and how the wine was destroyed by Prohibition agents are in ATF files that still exist today. Some of it was dumped because it was aging and the winemakers could not pay the bonds. Some of it was dumped because the bonds hadn't been paid and Prohibition officers would arrive and hack barrels of wine into smithereens with axes. Some was dumped because the owners had been caught bootlegging, and dumping a bootlegging family's wine was one of the penalties. 25,000 gallons here, 70,000 gallons there. Wine was spilled everywhere. It was unceremoniously dumped into rivers, into creeks, down hills, into gardens, through vegetable gardens, across driveways. Millions of gallons of wine in Northern California was destroyed by Prohibition agents during that period. Wine that had taken the mostly small families who owned it many years of hard work to produce. And talk about an ecological disaster. You know, people claimed orchards were ruined. I mean, it was just a terrible situation. One of the pioneers I spoke to remembered when the Russian River, now home to some of the world's great Pinots, ran red for hours because of the wine being dumped in it. Some people in town said he thought it was a sign that the end of the world had come because they'd never seen such a thing. Why was there so much wine around at the beginning of Prohibition? Well, people in Napa and Sonoma were frankly stunned that Prohibition had happened and had made no real preparations for it. They had thought it might last for a month or two at most. Some of them thought it might not happen at all. And on top of that, many of them were totally surprised that wine was included in the list of forbidden drinks during Prohibition. Many had thought the drinking problem in the nation that Prohibition forces had railed about was about alcohol. Many thought that only hard liquor was going to be banned, not wine. There had been an anti-alcohol movement in the States for many years. Why, even in the Civil War, generals admonished their men to drink less. By the time Prohibition was looming, wine people in Sonoma and Napa believed that the battle was about hard liquor and where it was sold, the saloon. The saloon was seen as a den of vice where men drank away their paychecks. And the most powerful anti-alcohol organization in the country, amazingly well-funded and which was spending millions of dollars each year in Congress and on politicians around the country to further its cause, was after all called the Anti-Saloon League. Its name alone had confounded the good people of Napa and Sonoma. Its leader was powerful, Wayne Wheeler. It was he who said, and I'll quote, he controlled six Congresses, dictated to two presidents of the United States, directed legislation in most of the states of the Union, picked the candidates for the more important elective state and federal offices, held the balance of power in both Republican and Democratic parties, and distributed more patronage than a dozen other men. He was a mighty foe, and talk about the mother of all Washington lobbyists. He makes the most recent lobbyists we've seen in Congress look like amateurs. The beer, whiskey, and wine industries all had organizations as well to promote themselves, but they never got together to form an effective opponent. The wine industry in particular thought itself superior to beer and whiskey and did not want to be associated with them. Surprisingly, given the growing wine industry in California, this state even had its own prohibition movement that had been active for years, even in San Francisco. It had gathered a lot of strength during the gold rush years, when miners went on drunken binges for days and terrified communities lived in constant fear of the lawlessness that ensued. Even so, in the fall of 1919, when the people of Sonoma and Napa woke up one day to read headlines that said things like, "Bone dry America, now effective by Senate's vote," they were stunned. What was wrong with wine? They had been making it for more than a century. And for many Americans for decades before Prohibition, especially for winemaking immigrants like the Italians, the French, and the Germans, wine was as much a part of the daily routine as feeding the chickens or milking the family cow. But unlike most other imbibers across the country for whom beer and whiskey ruled, in Napa and Sonoma it was the homegrown hardy wines and rich fruity brandies that locals drank with pride and pleasure. For instance, I was told by some immigrant winemakers who lived through Prohibition that their fathers might start the day with a coffee and a brandy. Then they would pour the day's first glass of wine at mid-morning, followed by another at lunch, one in the late afternoon, and finally a small glass at dinner. These are small glasses to stimulate the appetite and to relax them after a hard day's work in the vineyards. Wine was a natural and expected accompaniment to every part of the day, and to those who lived in wine country, it seemed it had always been that way. All of them said to me that there was always a bottle of red wine on the table when I was a child. I heard that often. Wine had been a proud business to be involved in. Wine families loved their land and were proud of their vines. No, California winemakers had not been worried about Prohibition for some years. After all, hadn't anti-Prohibition voters beaten down three state measures in a row in 1914, in 1916, and 1918 when anti-alcohol forces got Prohibition on the ballot? All three measures were defeated. In 1914, the statewide Prohibition initiative lost by only a few votes in Los Angeles, but by 5-1 in San Francisco and by similar margins in wine country. There were two Prohibition amendments on the November 1916 state ballot, and the editor of the St. Helena Star, in admonishing readers to vote against Prohibition, reminded them that it would not only be Napa and Sonoma and other winemaking areas in the state that would suffer. Back then, when raisin orders in the Central Valley had been filled, the remaining grapes were sent up to Napa and Sonoma to be turned into wine, too. "Troubles in wine country would affect the whole state," said the editor. I quote, "The vine industry of California is its pride and its boast. 330,000 acres of her land is devoted to grapes, and every acre, whether wine, table, or raisin grape, is dependent on the wine industry for its continuance." If wine was banned, there would be a tough economic landing, not only in Napa and Sonoma, but for thousands of other farm families across the state. At that time, more than 39 of California's 58 counties had planted grapes of some kind. Surely a livelihood for so many would not be jeopardized by voters or legislation anywhere. When it became clear that Prohibition might be a serious threat and the government might expect them to plant something else in their vineyards, industry leaders implored the state government to agree to pay them some compensation if a shutdown of their industry ever happened. There was an eerie silence on this issue whenever it was broached. No one ever got a cent from any level of government for the losses they would suffer. In fact, the government said to them essentially, "Go grow something else." Given the shallow soil and wine country, that would have been a terrific challenge. As well, growing grapes and making wine was what these families had done for decades. It was what they knew. The horticultural commissioner of the time wrote, "The man who does not know thinks a vineyardist can simply hook out his vines and replant something equally profitable in a few years. A greater fallacy never existed. Viticulture as a science is vast and absorbing. Thousands of men spend their whole lives in its study." And I love this ending. "It would be just as easy to take a lawyer and tell him he would have to make a go of it as a doctor." But the real battle over Prohibition was not in California, but was taking place in the halls of Congress. In this battle, California was completely outgunned, with only 11 elected representatives at that time because of its population. Pennsylvania, for example, had 36, New York 43. California was a remote place across beyond the mountains to Congress, and it did not get the attention it deserved. And not all of California's 11 congressmen would vote against liquor control. Some of those from Southern California would always believe Prohibition and the ban of alcohol was a good thing. Northern Californians never voted that way. There was always a north-south split in the on prohibition, but the North was always able to lead the state. California as a state never, ever voted for prohibition. So when Congress passed the 18th Amendment to ban all alcohol in the country and sent the amendment out for ratification across the country, where it needed 36 of the then 48 states to vote in favor of it, Californians were shocked when the dry majority politicians in Sacramento voted in favor of the 18th Amendment. This is one of the great tragedies of California governance. Against the express wishes of the voters, Sacramento ratified prohibition. Californians, especially in Northern California, were simply stunned. Not that one of our own representatives in Washington had not put up a great fight. The representative for Napa and Sonoma was a brilliant speaker. He was warm and passionate. Ex-lawyer Clarence Lee had offered up one of the most impassionate pleas ever heard in the House in defense of the California wine industry. And his constituents back home, whose lives depended on it. Just before the prohibition legislation was passed, he pleaded with such eloquence. He said in a speech on a hot summer afternoon in Capitol Hill, "Today there is hanging on the vines in California," this is just before the prohibition legislation went through, "today there is hanging on the vines, approaching harvest time, perhaps the greatest grape crop in the history of California. If this proposed legislation, prohibition law, goes into effect and thereby robs those wine grape farmers of California of the fruits of their labor, it will be one of the greatest outrages committed in the legislative history of the United States." No one was listening to him. After some shameful behavior, which is in the book, on part of some of the leaders of Congress who very much wanted prohibition to happen with no regard for a major linchpin of the California economy, prohibition legislation was passed into law. So prohibition began. Winery owners and grape ranchers wondered what they would do with their wine and their grapes, the millions of gallons of wine and the tens of thousands of acres of vineyards. Should they store the wine, destroy it? What should they do with their vines? Should they pull them up and replace them with prunes? Should they sell their vineyards and try yet a whole other line of work? They looked around for answers. Some officials advised them to get out of the business promptly, but had no further suggestions as to how they might survive. Some winemakers tried to dry grapes, but they knew that dried wine grapes would bring them little return. These grapes had pits, and they were on the market in competition with the vast raisin grape ranches of Central California with their Thompson seedless raisins. Some tried to make grape syrup for pancakes and for cooking, but people said it had a really awful cooked taste. Soon, vineyard owners realized that they would not have to answer this difficult question about their future just yet, because something surprising had happened. Wine grapes, fresh wine grapes, were suddenly in demand. Inquiries by local buyers of grapes in Northern California would provide the first inkling that grape growers might benefit from prohibition. And it was not long before grape salesmen from across the country began ordering grapes in massive quantities. Napa County grape dealers Merriam and Cairns were one of the early companies to ship a carload of fresh wine grapes east. The first they declared ever to be shipped from St. Helena, rather than being turned into wine locally. In the weeks to follow, the company boasted it would ship 16 more carloads from St. Helena and 28 from Rutherford. Other sales of fresh grapes were soon reported in the wine counties. Soon profits from grapes broke all records. The winemakers and grape growers were in shock yet again. Grapes were selling in states that opposed prohibition, of course, but they were also in demand by grape buyers from states that had voted for prohibition. Buyers from major and minor markets across the country were frantic to sign up future grape harvests throughout Napa and Sonoma, and they flocked west. Soon carloads of grapes were zipping across the nation to Boston, to Chicago, to Philadelphia, to Detroit, to New York, to nearly every large city, all thanks to a strange law that had been passed many years before and which had not been canceled out by prohibition legislation, that every householder in the nation was permitted to make 200 gallons wine in their own home for their own use. It was a revolving door, of course. You could make 200 gallons, drink 200 gallons, make 200 gallons, drink 200 gallons. This was not only a boon to the millions and millions of ordinary Americans who began to make wine in prohibition, but it was a huge business opportunity to the nation's vast legion of bootleggers who also made 200 gallons, sold 200 gallons, made 200 gallons. Well, you get the picture. Prices for grapes jumped from $30 a ton to $50 a ton to $100 a ton to $250 a ton. Suddenly, there were not enough refrigerated rail cars to go around to get the fruit to market. This was a problem winemakers and grape growers never thought that they would have. During the long journey through the heat of late summer and fall, the fruit needed to be cooled, and the ice needed to be replenished many times as the trains raced across the country. Huge amounts of ice had to be produced across the country to keep the reefers cold. In Roseville, just northeast of Sacramento, a massive ice-making facility had to be built, and by 1924, it was making hundreds of thousands of tons of ice each year. Roseville could ice hundreds of refrigerator cars simultaneously and thousands per day. Each grape rail car was stacked with more than 10,000 pounds of ice as it set off east. Suddenly, the grape growers of Napa and Sonoma were making money hand over fist, and they thought, if this is prohibition, bring it on. But the wine grape growers and winery owners who were making money hand over fist did not know it then. But there was a very large dark cloud on the horizon. And that dark cloud was the raisin grape growers of Central California. Central California had always voted for prohibition and had never supported their brothers and sisters in the northern wine vineyards. Now farmers and raisin grape growers down the valley saw profits piling up in Napa and Sonoma. And so, well, yes, they began to pull out their raisin grapes. They also shipped some raisin grapes to make wine with, but they started to pull out their raisin grapes and plant wine grapes. Only a few years later, given such increased plantings, as evident by the growth in the wine grape acreage in the state that I quoted earlier, supplies of California wine grapes grew so immense that thousands of rail cars of California wine grapes began to arrive to eastern markets that were diminishing. Suddenly, there was a terrific surplus of grapes. Now the cars of grapes sat in the heat and rotted as they waited for buyers that were not going to materialize. This spelt disaster, and it started a bitter, ugly battle between the wine grape growers around here and the new wine grape growers of the Central Valley. As well, many grape growers were not sophisticated businessmen, and this was dangerous for business. Some grape growers who had cut deals with shippers could not read or could not completely understand the terms of the contracts. Some couldn't understand English and were all stunned to receive rail car bills for ruined fruit, because if the contracts insisted that if the fruit arrived damaged, and it would arrive damaged if it sat for 2 or 3 weeks outside New York City in the heat, they had to pay for the transportation. One invoice for a situation like that and a small grape grower could be out of business permanently. One wine grower from Geyserville in Sonoma sent the family crop down east and got back a 17-cent check. It was ruinous to these small-time grape growers. The implosion of the wine grape markets only got worse later on as the beginnings of the Great Depression through 1927, 1928 meant that few people, wherever they lived in the country, had money to make wine and the market completely collapsed. I should add that New Orleans never bought wine grapes, and the reason why I found out was they didn't have any basements because of the way they built their houses. So they did make wine grapes from 25-pound boxes. They made wine from 25-pound boxes of raisins, and it made a clear wine, and they used to color it with red food dye, which I thought did not sound good. The implosion meant that there were not so many customers as well, and prices tumbled to where it was hardly worth picking the grapes. Yes, little had anyone in California's wine country known in those first heady years of wine grape sales in Prohibition that the markets would eventually crash and burn with horrendous results, that they would have to turn virtually en masse to illegal selling of wine and grappa and brandy to survive, to pay taxes, etc., that this would result in brutal raids and jail terms and blackmailing and coercion by prohibition officers, and that crime would become a part of their daily lives as they struggled to survive by bootlegging and running stills. The poisoning cases that were happening were especially offensive to winemakers in Napa and Sonoma. When two residents, along with Mrs. Ivy Cord, the 36-year-old dietitian at the veterans' home in Yountville, died from drinking poisoned alcohol, and often that poison was put in by the government into its government-controlled stocks to stop people from stealing it and selling it again. But they put benzene and all kinds of things, which was another big battle in Congress about what they should put in to poison people. because there was a big debate about, you know, was prohibition about trying to poison people and kill citizens? Wasn't it about trying to improve people's health, you know, by removing alcohol from it? So when those three folk died, local winemakers with thousands of gallons of good, honest wine still sitting in padlocked cellars declared the government mad that people would die from drinking poison when there was wonderful Napa wine everywhere just waiting to be drunk. It was inexplicable, they thought. And wine folk hadn't known either that there would be constant battles with officers in the Prohibition Bureau, a bureau that was so rife with corruption as this country has ever seen. For the first 5 years of Prohibition, no exams or tests or qualifications were legally necessary to become a Prohibition agent. And so the force was packed with buddies of friends and politicians, with criminals and incompetents. Once they were called an army of bandits, and many of them were charged with all sorts of felonies. It was another horrific part of the nightmare of Prohibition in the wine country. Soon the courts would be so full of Prohibition cases they came almost to a standstill. At a Senate committee hearing in 1926, judges complained bitterly they did not have the resources to try anything other than Prohibition cases now. Other cases were all stuck in the pipeline, while cases like bootlegging and other liquor offenses took precedence. Arrests for drunkenness in San Francisco went from 1,800 in 1920 to 8,000 in the middle of Prohibition in 1925. Prohibition was not working as promised. Gangsters from San Francisco soon invaded the wine counties. There were shootings and murders on lonely roads as there were fortunes to be made in the remote hills of Napa and Sonoma, where big stills could be put and no one would ever find out about them. And soon even families would join into the fray. Here's a final reading from the book, and let me set it up again. The Colombano family of northern Sonoma lived on a remote road. The farming family had bootlegged in a small way for some years, and a small still was contributing daily to the Cut family's coffers. Eligio Colombano drove his Model T to San Francisco to sell his grappa. One day he got an offer that made his small operation pale in comparison. A big-time bootlegger from San Francisco named Palosi came to the small farm and offered $50 a day if the family would let him operate a still in their barn. Somehow, Palosi had obtained a huge supply of port, however we'll never know, sitting padlocked in a winery about a mile from the Colombano farm. Palosi wanted to turn that port into brandy and ship it down to San Francisco at great profit. Money was no object. Palosi soon ran a 2-inch galvanized tin pipeline from the winery to the still in the Colombano's barn. Men dug all night to install it. And they even dug it under the railway track, which had a fair amount of traffic on it in those days. Colombano's wife fed the hordes of workers it took to do this, and they slept in cots at the farmhouse. When Palosi realized there was no electricity at the farmhouse, no problem. He spliced into the nearest power lines and buried a line in the ground next to the galvanized wine pipeline. The power company never knew it was subsidizing one of the biggest stills in the state. So, from the book. Palosi's still was huge. At a time when many stills were about the size of a baby's bath and held 5 gallons of liquor, this one stretched 10 to 12 feet in diameter, about the volume of a medium-sized bedroom. Now that the pipeline was dug and camouflaged and the power was in, it was time to start up the still. The Colombanos were by turns stunned, then terrified at the noise. It made a terrible roar, remembers Colombano, whom I interviewed for this. A terrible roar. You could hear it everywhere, echoing up the hills and mountains, we thought. My mother Angela was hardly sleeping by then. She was so scared. But the gambit worked. Brandy poured out of the still in an endless stream day and night. Palosi's crew could fill a 5-gallon can, kept camouflaged by hay, in the barn in just a few minutes. There were 3 shifts a day, and 4 people were needed on each shift. 12 people in all each day were working on it, and my mother struggled so hard feeding them, but they did purchase all the food for her to cook. The liquor was taken away to San Francisco at night. Some was transported down to the city in a big car driven by a woman from Hawaii who would stop and eat a meal prepared by Eligio's wife before setting off on her journey through the night. This woman used to eat her dinner, have a glass of wine with it, maybe even a grappa, and then light up a cigar, recollected Columbano. We couldn't believe our eyes. Back then, we'd never seen anyone smoke in our house ever. My mother was dumbstruck. Columbano's dad was making his $50 a day for the use of the barn, and the still had been operating 24 hours a day for 10 days when Pelosi suddenly announced that operations would have to cease immediately. I'm going to send a crew in, he said. We have to get this thing out of here in 24 hours. Pelosi had received a tip from one of his paid informants that the barn was to be raided. They had only a day to erase all traces of the giant still. It seemed impossible. First, the Kathaskoff apart with its chimney and all the cooking and evaporating paraphernalia had to be completely taken apart piece by piece. And then were the cans, some empty, many filled, hidden under the straw. The staff, their cots, everything had to be vanished by the next day. But by God, they did it, said Columbano. They worked and worked, and in 24 hours, every single thing was gone from the barn. The only things left from the operation were the pipeline and the electrical connections. But the Prohibition agents missed those completely when they visited. Like most Prohibition agents, these had probably been paid off to give Pelosi notice before they came. One family told me that they paid for, they had a hotel that had a bar that used to run whenever there were no agents around. And they say they paid $400 a month for that deal to their local Prohibition agent. It was a symbiotic arrangement that happened all the time. But it was a venal, upsetting arrangement that angered wine country folk by its deceit, fraudulence, and crookedness. I'm going to leave you there today since my time is up, and with many, many, many more stories about Prohibition yet to tell. There were so many. And I thank you so much for listening to me today, and I'm so happy to answer questions, and I hope that I do have the answers for you. Oh, okay. I think I've solved this one. Did wineries receive any compensation from the government when they were forced to stop selling wine? No, there was nothing. And there was never any effort. There was a man called Bismarck Bruck who was a state legislature from Napa, and he tried many times. He just could not get the vote going that way in Sacramento, and so it didn't happen, although there were those many efforts. Were there any infamous bootleggers like Joe Kennedy Sr. on the West Coast? There were none. That it seemed that I think a lot of Sacramento wine went to Chicago. I think there was a huge supply of wine. In fact, there was on the very night of Prohibition. Prohibition that happened at 12:01 on the 17th of January, and about 12:02, there was a robbery in Chicago where something like $25,000 worth of wine was sold. I think they had no problems getting wine. So were there gangsters? Yes, they were. But I think we actually did a good job on homegrown gangsters in those days. What was the reaction from Europe to Prohibition? Well, there had been some people from the Prohibition movement that went to Europe. One person went to London and did not get very far with the British House of Parliament, although they had some supporters in the country. France did not take the whole thing seriously. The one thing they did like, and the one thing that winemakers did say to me about Prohibition, was that they had these 14 years when they didn't make wine. A lot of winemaking skills were lost because then it was the next generation of winemakers. For instance, Lou Fulpiano told me, you know, his father had died early. He didn't really have anyone to show him. He had to go and find how to make good premium wine. And winemakers felt that they had lost ground to countries like Australia and France, who were able to make wine during this period and had improved things, and they had not been able to. So they felt that they started the next generation of wine at a decided disadvantage because of Prohibition. Can you talk more about the relationship between the wine industry and the Catholic Church? Was the wine being used for more than sacraments? Well, that's a good question. I think there was something like, there were some, about 5 years into Prohibition, five times as much sacramental wine was being made as at the beginning of Prohibition. Whether five times more people started to go to church during Prohibition, we will all decide that for ourselves. But it was obvious that wine left here, and there was this astonishing relationship with Beaulieu, but it was all seemingly above board. They had an imprimatur, really, from the Archbishop to make wine, and they were recommended to many churches. But I think what happened, too, was there was there were other cases where people knew when sacramental wine was on the trains, and train people would then tell gangsters when it was coming. They got paid off. Trains would arrive completely empty. They'd stood in sidings for an evening or a night. There was one that left Beaulieu, that it was in Iowa. The wine just vanished. People knew it was there. The Catholic Church started to advise people to send it in larger barrels because the smaller barrels were easier to steal. So you can see that difficulty. One thing that was interesting to me, too, was that the Jewish faith also uses wine, as we know, in its ceremonies. And there was a terrific amount of wine that was being sold through fake rabbis in New York City. They would set themselves up and say rabbinical wine. I have photos of, you know, the signs up, temporary signs up over stores because they probably had to move on the next day. But a lot of wine was sold that way, and a lot of wine was made from California grapes. So there's no direct evidence, because certainly people did not keep records of their crimes. But then in the middle of Prohibition, the authorities did do something about it, and they brought that volume of sacramental wine down. But they made a lot of sacramental wine. During Prohibition, was there an attempt to confiscate private collections of wine from homes? No, you could keep your wine at home and you could serve your friends as long as you didn't try to move it and as long as you didn't try to sell it. The night before Prohibition, San Francisco was crazed with cars going all over the place and trucks as everyone trying to get as much wine into their homes as they could. The description from the Chronicle is amazing about just everyone was trying to get this stuff moving. People, even stores where there were many wineries who had agencies in New York and Chicago, and they even reported that they had just so much business that they had to call in the cops at one point. They just couldn't keep up with it that last few days. So people were trying to get it into their houses, not knowing how long this might last. Is the poet Losi in your book related to Nancy Pelosi? Good question. It's spelled differently, so I suspect not. It's P-A-L-O-S-I. So I think there are two strains of that family, and this was obviously a different one. How did wineries recover from Prohibition? Slowly. They did recover slowly. It took time to get things back into working order. One of the reasons why many of them wanted to keep wine in their tanks was because those beautiful redwood tanks, if you took the wine out or the liquid out, they would dry up and become useless. So people tried to keep the wine as long as they could. Of course, they could top them up with water, but it seemed obvious that, you know, some of the wines in California then were amazing wines, wonderful premium wines. The California Wine Association had amazing wines from very early vintages. So we're not just talking about, you know, Planck that was made, you know, the day, you know, weeks before and, you know, or even a year before. People had wine collections. You know, wineries had their library wines. And there was just so many wines around, but still people did not know how to make wine particularly. And it just took some time for it to get back again. And some of the relationships, the relationship that made wine happen across the states with buyers into New York City and into New Orleans, those things took a long time again to get going. So they felt that it had been a huge bump for them. Although they were all making wine the fall before Prohibition was rescinded, they all suspected that it was going to happen, and none of them did not want to have wine on hand. So the Asti Winery had lots of wine on hand. Other wineries had wine on hand and could get back into the business quickly. But for many other people, it was a long, slow process, and it was some time, I think, before it got back to where it was beforehand. So I thank you all. Those were good questions. Oh, do you have one more question? Well, I think one of the major reasons why Prohibition started to become unpopular was that the Depression came, and people needed the revenue and people needed the jobs. Some of the women's movements got into it because of that. Trade unions never supported Prohibition. Right from the get-go, they spoke at, you know, Senate and congressional hearings about how they believed that the working man was entitled to his bottle of beer or his glass of whiskey. And their voices became stronger as the Depression moved in. And there was a tremendous amount of other people, of course, that are involved in winemaking and beer making, whiskey making, from barrel makers to the delivery men to the people that had the horses to deliver things. There was a tremendous amount of jobs that everyone knew. And the other thing was there was a big Senate investigation in about 1929, and we found out, again, all the people that worked in the Prohibition Bureau that had been charged with crimes. The courts were blocked. It wasn't working. Drinking was more prevalent than ever. It just became clear that if we want people to drink less, it was probably not the way to go about it. Education was starting to be seen as the way to do it. So there were a number of factors that kind of, you know, made that perfect storm that stopped it. So
what
You know, I don't know about that. What happened, I do know that in Napa and Sonoma, there were agricultural stations that still were working to help them grow good wine, but they were... So that's a good question. I'm going to find that out. One last question.
Okay. Was there any attempt to export the wine, or was that illegal?
That was absolutely illegal. You could not sell anything, and you could not... That's why all those ships were moving out fast from the port of San Francisco. And... There were so many trains a few days going into Mexico with wine the days before, just before Prohibition, that there was a huge traffic jam. Nobody could deal with the amount of trains because it was a good place to go put it, and you could sell it then from ports there. But if you had wine here, and people kept making wine. They didn't know what to do with their – they could make it, and then you had to call the, you know, the agency in, and you would then get it padlocked. Some of them kept making it for a while because they didn't know what else to do with their grapes. By the end of Prohibition, they were dispirited and people weren't sometimes picking them. So it was tough times, but good times for others too. So I thank you all, your fabulous audience.
Thank you to Vivian Sanowski, author of When the Rivers Ran Red, A Fascinating History of California and Prohibition. This is the end of the Commonwealth program for today. Thank you.